This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson, and my usual co-hosts Katie, Joanna, Mike are all off doing different interesting things, but that means I get to be joined by VF film critic Cam Collins.
Hi, everyone.
And our wonderful editor, Hilary Busis.
Hello.
So I brought you guys on today to talk about a couple things. Well, we have Cameron here, and we're also going to talk about Cameron Post, The Miseducation of, the movie that won Sundance this year, struggled to find distribution, and is now finally coming out. We're also going to talk to Cam about a wonderful piece he wrote about Spike Lee and Black Klansman that is now available to read on VF.com. But first, in the news lately, there's been a lot of talk about MoviePass, and I am assuming that our listenership is familiar with this service, which was an app that started, I think, like 7 years ago, but really only gained popularity last year when they basically introduced this insane deal, which was that you paid $10 a month and could basically see unlimited first-run movies. Were either of you on the service?
Yeah. I mean, I was part of the wave of new people from the last year. I was part of the first wave of people who had to wait like 3 months to get our card in the mail.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Which was the first sign, I think, for many of us that
it was too good to be true.
Yeah, that it was too good to be true. Like, from that moment of them being so overwhelmed by all these new customers, despite dropping their price so low that it was obvious that half the country would sign up, them being so taken aback by that and unprepared was a sign.
Yeah, I actually didn't sign up just because one of the great perks of our job is that we get to see a lot of movies early and for free. And so I figured that I probably wouldn't use MoviePass enough to actually justify buying it. But I got a gift subscription after Hanukkah. So I was using it until it abruptly cut out a few weeks ago. And then I was like, do I want to really re-up this when the company is going down in flames? So I am not a MoviePass user currently anymore.
And the company really is in trouble. And the reason I'm bringing it up this week is that it was just announced that they're now upping the subscription price to $15 a month. And most crucially, they're not supporting first-run movies. So anything that opens in more than 1,000 theaters, you can't see using MoviePass for, I think it's 2 weeks. So, you know, you could wait 2 weeks to see Mission Impossible or The Meg or whatever.
But could you? Could you
like,
really?
Yeah. I would think that some people who are, like, really into MoviePass are, like, seeing, you know, things when they open that weekend. Like, that's important to them. So I'll be curious to see if MoviePass can survive. But for the time being, I feel like on film Twitter and stuff, there's just a lot of eulogizing for this kind of, again, too good to be true, insane thing that in a way was sort of stealing money from venture capitalists
and giving it
to people who just wanted to see movies, which is kind of great.
An interesting thing about being in a city like New York with MoviePass is that there are just so many like rep cinemas. Like, you can go see what's new in theaters, but there are also plenty of theaters where you can go see old things. And a lot of the people that I know were using it to see older things and were using it to sort of get a film education. And that was a substantial number of people. Like, a lot of students use MoviePass. And so that's what makes me a little, you know, sad, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, maybe not from a business perspective, but from like an altruism perspective, if MoviePass kind of evolves into this service that you can use basically in order to see movies that you may not have seen otherwise, to see, you know, indies and repertory films and things like that. I mean, that does not seem as lucrative of a hook to get people to sign up for it as, like, you can see Mission Impossible 6 times in theaters if you want to. Although the other thing that MoviePass has done over like this this fall that just happened didn't happen quickly. It's been a gradual kind of series of increased restrictions and increased rules on the service. Like they made a rule about surge pricing, like taking a page out of Uber's book, which worked out so well for Uber. They started limiting the number of times you could see a certain movie, and it would be like checked off. You wouldn't be able to go back and see it again, which I think a lot of people were doing before they stopped letting people do that. So you could kind of see this coming if you were reading the tea leaves.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I like the idea of it as almost kind of a library card, you know? So like, Right. Yeah, you're not getting the new shiny, you know, hardcover, but like you can see the movie eventually. And, you know, I just know like anecdotally with my friends who are, you know, civilians are not in our line of work who, you know, pay to see movies like normal people. All of a sudden there was just this market uptick in like conversation I was having with just people about movies they saw. Usually it would be like, they'd go see Call Me By Your Name, and that was like the movie they saw that year, you know?
Right.
And this year, but it's been so many, and I really feel, just in a sort of selfish personal way, like it's sad to lose that. Like, I think it reminded a lot of people that they like going to movies, but it just becomes so prohibitively expensive. And I wonder if there's like another way to do that. And AMC, the theater chain, has sort of entered now into the conversation where they have this $20 a month, you can see anything at AMC. But, you know, is AMC going to run The Miseducation of Cameron Post? I don't think so.
Right. And their seats are bad. So, I mean, yeah, you know, it's funny how the life cycle of MoviePass has been so fast. Remember when they were in movie distribution? I saw, what was it,
Did you
American
see Gotti?
Animals? I didn't see Gotti. That's a perfect MoviePass movie. But I saw American Animals, which I believe that they helped distribute. And it seemed like they were trying to make the step that Netflix made long into the history of Netflix. They were trying to make it now. I'm just doing everything much too quickly and taking on much too much.
I mean, remember Quickster?
Oh my God.
What was Quickster?
Netflix briefly split into two companies. There was one focused on streaming and one focused on DVDs. And I think the DVD one was called Quickster, like with a QW, like at the beginning.
Okay, I vaguely, God, were we ever so young?
Yeah, no, and their stock plunged and everybody was like, Netflix is over. And this was, I think, pre-House of Cards. So it figured out a way to come back. So hey, maybe if MoviePass wants to... Well, not Kevin Spacey, but
something.
Maybe there's a way for MoviePass to find out some new pivot.
Yeah, maybe. And I think it's funny that idea. I think one of you said about American Animals, like of a MoviePass movie, where like we tend to talk about like plane movies. Not everyone gets to, you know, fly on long haul flights and watch movies on planes, but like, you know, there's a certain level of like, I would say I haven't seen I Feel Pretty. I will confidently, happily watch that on a plane.
Right.
And I think that was starting to happen with MoviePass. But what was nice about that was also that people could do it more regularly, and you could get out of your house. And I don't know. Do we think there's any glimmer of hope that, like, even if the good deal goes away, people will just still be in the habit of going to movies?
Well, you know, what MoviePass really clarified, I think, was how much people really do like to go to the movies.
Yeah.
That, like,
and just how expensive it is.
Just how expensive it is. And that was really, I mean, right, because the story we were all telling was movies are on the decline. No one wants to see anything. They're only going out for blockbusters. And I think that this MoviePass drama has proven that actually there is a hunger. There are other things in the way. So the theater chains and studios, I think, should be thinking about this. I think the decline in MoviePass, but the upsurge in interest in movies.
If the only choices that a studio can have are A, mid-budget pictures just go to Netflix and movie theaters only show giant $300 million budget blockbusters, or we have some kind of subscription service that people can use in order to see smaller budget things like And I Feel Pretty, like a documentary, then maybe they will see the benefit of that.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're selling concessions. Like, that's big money,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Wasn't there a movie that just...
Big popcorn.
Right, yeah. The big snowcap industry. Wasn't there a movie that was just sold to Netflix? Or, like, kind of unloaded on Netflix? I mean, we saw it with Annihilation.
Oh, yeah, Andy Serkis's Jungle
right.
Book.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And so, like, it's really depressing to see that. And that's, like, a huge, like, visual feast kind of movie. And now it's just going to be people watching it on their laptops or their...
Or on a plane screen.
Or on a plane
Which is
screen.
Worse. Those
Much
are small.
Worse.
Yeah, they're tiny.
The resolution is bad.
It's terrible.
Everyone knows what you're watching.
Yeah.
The guy next to you is just watching Deadpool.
I'm a plane spy. I definitely take note of what everyone's watching.
Oh, absolutely. I watched Flying Somewhere, and I decided to rewatch Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some, was that
what
it's called?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just because it's a fun movie and it's like boys in baseball pants.
Right.
But like I was on a plane with like children on it and I kept like, and there's not like nudity, but I kept covering the screen. I was like so embarrassed.
No, you want to know something funny? This is totally tangential, but I've noticed that movies that don't do well in theaters do well on planes. Like the movies where we were all like, no one wants to watch that. Like what was like The Gunslinger, the Stephen King movie that was like the Idris Elba.
The Dark Tower.
The Dark Tower, yeah. I was on an international flight recently where that was what most people were watching. And I thought, where were you?
Well, yeah, because they wouldn't pay $17 for it.
Totally. Which is like, again, it's just like, I think it's not a matter of interest. Yeah. I think it's a matter of, well, leaving the house, A, and B, paying $17 for a movie that's probably bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's a lot of risk incurred, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's something that, I don't know if you've gotten the same, either of you have gotten the same kind of like, line of frustration from a reader, but like years ago, I reviewed Battleship, the Peter Berg, you know, alien mess.
Rihanna's screen debut.
Yeah, well, she, you know, she was Oscar nominated for it, obviously. But, you know, and I was like, oh, that was so stupid, but so fun. And like, I had a great time. It's big and loud and things blow up. And I kind of reviewed it as such. And a reader emailed me and said, you know, like, I appreciate that you had a good time, but like, you didn't pay $17.50 plus parking, plus your kids' tickets, plus popcorn, whatever. Like, this is a $100 outing for a family. And like, if it's a piece of shit, like, we kind of like want to know that. So like, I think that something in a selfish sense that MoviePass did is it made me feel a little bit like less concerned about that because like maybe, you know, the financial burden wasn't as much. So I hope that we can find a way to alleviate that for people because it was fun when everyone was seeing things.
It really was. Imagine how much.
Remember gathering around the water cooler, talking about the latest episode of Ally McBeal.
Exactly, it's so that dancing baby.
MoviePass could have made like it possible for people to have seen the Oscar movies for once.
That was the first thing I used mine for. Was I finally saw Shape of Water? I was like very, very late to that. It was in January.
I used my MoviePass the first time to see Tulip Fever, which was meant to be an Oscar movie.
Oh, that is another topic entirely.
But that was very much a movie that I was like, I am not paying money to see this, even though I have to review it. There weren't screenings of it. I should have taken that as a sign. So I used my MoviePass the morning that it dropped in New York and was like, this is the perfect thing to use MoviePass for. I feel like I haven't lost any dignity.
This is exactly the kind of thing that distributors need to hear, though. I mean, like, maybe somewhere like Matthew McConaughey is wandering around like a Texan desert and he's like, if only MoviePass had been around when the dark. I think it was, actually, but yeah. Well, one movie that will be contending for viewers coming up in, I think it's 2 weeks, is Black Klansman, which premiered at Cannes to a pretty good reception. It won the equivalent of second place. And in the interim between then and now, you, Cam, have gone and interviewed Spike. You went to Fort Greene, right?
Right, right.
So what was that experience like? Had you met him before?
I had not met him before. I'd written on him before, but we'd never met, and I went to visit him on the set of She's Gotta Have It season 2 for, speaking of Netflix, and so got a little time with him on set, which is great to see how directors work and how they interact with people. And
your story is so great, but one of my favorite things about it is how, like, walking down the streets of Fort Greene, like, everybody knows Spike. Everybody, like, wants to say hi to Spike.
It's crazy. I mean,
he's like the mayor.
Yeah, it's notable as a New Yorker, and I didn't say this in the piece, and I probably should have, that, like, no one does that. Like, you're supposed to ignore celebrities. When I saw Michael Fassbender in my neighborhood, first of all, he was glaring at everyone so that they wouldn't talk to him. But also just, like, no one talked to him. You just don't do that. But with Spike, it was every single person that we passed in this, like, 3 or 4 block walk stopped and said hello.
And there was sort of a colloquial quality to it. It wasn't, like, a big, like, oh, my God, sign an autograph. It was like, hey. Right?
Yeah, right. Because he's around.
Yeah. He's like a neighborhood fixture.
Yeah. And that was just – that was – it was interesting, right? Because, you know, I think most people identify him with his 80s and 90s movies. And I think his sort of 21st century run has been, for some people, just highs and lows, but mostly lows after movies like Inside Man. And I think he's taking a lot of artistic risks, but they're not making, you know, they're not making the kind of money, et cetera, that he was getting earlier in his career. So it's just interesting that in terms of persona, that he's still this huge. There are only a few directors that I think could walk down the street and everyone would say hello to them. And like Scorsese, Spike Lee, Steven Spielberg, And then other people, I think, would largely be left alone.
Yeah. Well, just because who really knows what most directors look like?
Right. Like, the hipsters would say hi to Paul Thomas Anderson. We all know what he looks like.
They would weep.
Right. I would certainly say hi to Sofia Coppola if I saw her on the street. But, like, a lot of people would just be like, yeah, no, who are you?
But he not only because he's such a local in his neighborhood of Brooklyn, but, like, I think he engenders that because something you get at in this piece really well is that his movies have such a particular sort of tone and style, even though he's done different genre and whatever. But there's this kind of this core urgency to his movies that, you know, has been around since the 80s. And something that I think people like myself responded to in BlacKkKlansman was that, like, some of that spirit felt a little bit more renewed, you know.
Right.
And you know, he's done interesting things recently, like Chirac in particular. But BlacKkKlansman, I don't know. It just feels like it has the potential to, you know, kind of break through in a way that one of his movies hasn't in a long time. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I think that's the hope. I mean, it's a wider release than he's gotten in a little while. And, you know, this is a Jordan Peele project initially. And Spike was brought on to revise the script and direct the movie. But it was originally a Jordan Peele Blumhouse collaboration. And I think the hope was always that it was going to be big, in part because of the moment. It's a movie about a cop, a black cop, sort of infiltrating the KKK. A black cop and a Jewish cop infiltrating the KKK.
Based on a true story.
Based on a true story, by a memoir by a man named Ron Stallworth, who's the real black cop, rather. And it's just too good to be true in terms of, like, a movie. Like, what kind of, you know?
Yeah.
We've seen this kind of Chappelle skit version of this, but this is too good to be true. And it's also just, you hear the plot description and you think, yeah, that's a Spike Lee movie, right? It's, like, ridiculous in the right way. It's political in the right way. And I think the movie really carries that. And it's also just, you know, it's got, like, Adam Driver in it. It's got Topher Grace as David Duke, which is really an interesting performance. And I would totally tell people to see it on the basis of that alone because it's so weird.
And you spoke to Topher Grace for the piece. And, you know, he said basically, I would not have played this role for any other director.
Right. I mean, right. He gave me I really walked away from that conversation with a sense of, this is a risk. Playing a white supremacist in a movie right now in particular is a risk. I wouldn't want to do it for someone who I wouldn't think would do well by the subject.
Especially playing, like, the world's friendliest white supremacist,
right,
which his David Duke is.
Right. He's just so chipper. It's disconcerting. But also accurate to a moment in the KKK when David Duke really was trying to polish everyone up. And in the movie, there's this contrast between the sort of stereotypical, like, Southern hick KKK member and David Duke, who is polite, will shake your hand even if you're black. He hates you. He thinks you have no rights.
He'll keep
but
it
he's
to
cordial.
Himself for the minute. Yeah.
Right. Right. You know, it's an interesting movie. I think that people will really respond to it.
And even though it's a period piece set in the 70s, Lee brings into the present at the end in a very, you know, potent way. But, like, it just has so many, you know, similarities in terms of conversations we're having now about race and racism and, you know, not just kind of the latent personal kind of racism, but organized racism and this really scary resurgence of it. And what I think BlacKkKlansman does, it says, well, no, it's not a resurgence. It's always been there. It's just we're now paying attention to it. And what I'm curious about is, you know, well, last year, pretty clumsily, Kathryn Bigelow tried to wade into this, you know, topic with Detroit. And, you know, a lot of viewers were like, this was really irresponsibly done. Obviously, Lee is coming from a different perspective. But do we think, like, what is the kind of public appetite for a fictionalized film about this topic? You know, I think about in the, you know, the aughts when they, you know, directors kept trying to give us the Iraq War movie that we needed and no one wanted it. Like, all those movies tanked. Well, not tanked exactly, but, you know, they didn't do well. So are we, like, do we think that there is people are wanting to see the stuff that BlacKkKlansman is about on screen right now?
I think BlacKkKlansman will play a bit better than something like Detroit, for example, because at least personally and amongst friends, I think what a lot of us are getting allergic to, if we're not already, is violence against black people in movies. It's just between, like, being online and seeing every day a new sort of video or another hashtag of a dead black person. It's just, I don't really want to see that repeated in movies, particularly in the case of Detroit. It was just, It was traumatic, and I don't think it was worth it.
It was a horror movie.
Yeah,
was,
and yeah. just the movie never circled back around to making me think, well, it was worth seeing this violence that I knew happened but maybe didn't know was this violent.
That's kind of how I feel about, like, The Handmaid's Tale. Like, yeah. I don't really need to watch women being raped and being denied care and, you know, being stripped of their rights. Like, that's happening in the real world. I don't know that watching it, like, a dramatization of it is necessarily helping.
Yeah, like, if you're going to do that,
you have to be saying something else,
you
too.
Have to, right. You have to have stakes there that are beyond. It's important to show these things because no one would disagree with you that we need to sort of bear witness to these things. But there's something to be said for just the trauma bearing witness. And if you're doing this responsibly, then you should be thinking about making that worthwhile. Like,
and Black Klansman also, I think, does a good job of kind of giving a spoonful of sugar. Because, I mean, I know that in the piece, Spike Lee told you that he doesn't think of the movie as a comedy, but there are a lot of comedic elements to it. I mean, you mentioned the Chappelle's Show, like, kind of underpinning to it, and it also reminds me a lot of Blazing Saddles, in that it is a movie about this, like, very suave, very smooth black man just, like, completely pulling one over on a gang of, like, white hick idiots. And, like, there is definitely something very satisfying about that, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think the thing that I'm curious about is to see, because one thing we just have not had in American movies at all is talking about, like, the KKK in the context of Jewish people.
Like, which is weird, yeah.
Which is weird because they're such a, like, an obvious target.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Something, like, yeah.
Never covert about their hatred of Jewish people at all.
No, totally. And something that I thought was really interesting in the movie was kind of the like dawning consciousness of the Adam Driver character when he's like, oh, I never really thought about myself as a Jew until I found out that these people hate me for this thing that I am that, like, is not really visibly apparent. Like,
right.
But that was really, I don't know, if anything, I kind of wish the movie had dug into that more.
Yeah, same, because that turned out to be, or at least just for me, the more surprising revelation was actually, I mean, we should say this whole thing starts because John David Washington's character decides to call the KKK to could be recruited. So the black character is the one on the phone with the KKK, but actually going to the meetings is Adam Driver's character. And immediately these Klan members sort of suspect that he's Jewish. And then there's just repeated scenes of increased tension over them trying to figure that out. And that was where the – frankly, for me, where the main tension in the movie was, because he's the one who's actually in the KKK meetings.
Like, putting his neck out there.
Right, right. Like, John David Washington, his character is definitely doing some stuff, but he's not at the meetings because he's black.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, like, in a way, like, that does – sap the movie of a little of its sort of tension because John David Washington is the central character and yet he's not the one doing the central action. So it kind of does become Adam Driver's movie, which is like not exactly like what I think the movie's pitched at thematically. But I also think, you know, you mentioned the spoonful of sugar, Hillary. There definitely is that, but it's tainted. And like at the very end, I don't want to spoil it exactly, but like I think that Spike Lee is like, hey, by the way, I know we were laughing, we're having a good time. Like, this is an interesting story, but like, this has such intense implications to the real world. And the release of the movie is timed very pointedly to the anniversary of the horrible events in Charlottesville last year. You know, so I really appreciate that this movie, unlike maybe The Handmaid's Tale, and certainly unlike Detroit, it has a sense of perspective that says, stuff is grim and dark and serious, but also, like, life is more complicated than that, and, like, there can be some levity and some silliness. And, like, yeah, like, some of these racist idiots are, like, funny because they're so stupid, you know, and they're so inept or whatever, but that doesn't mean that they are harmless,
right?
You know, and I think the movie is pitched really well, so I'll be curious to see. The thing about, you know, when I saw it at Cannes, and that is not a very diverse crowd of critics, let's say. You know, you get the initial reviews and it's lacking a certain perspective. And I'll be very curious to hear what black audiences think about it and what people who were around at that time think about it, you know. So I hope it's a hit. How did Lee seem? Was he kind of sanguine about its chances or?
He doesn't want to jinx it, but I think he's feeling really good about it.
Yeah.
And I think between this and just She's Gotta Have It doing well on Netflix, I think he's feeling good about. You know, I mean, I don't think that he's someone who's too attached to his commercial success. And I think that he likes to take risks and do whatever he wants. But like anyone else, I think he's glad that it seems like this is going to be something that people see and really relate to. And I think that's good. I think it's a good movie.
Did you talk at all about what he's got coming up besides She's Gotta Have It?
He wouldn't say, but there's got to be something, right? Mm-hmm. He seems extremely busy.
He's prolific,
he's done Uber commercials.
So you've written on him before and, you know, you've seen his films. Was there anything in talking to him that surprised you that he said, or sort of was he the person you kind of expected him to be?
He was exactly what I expected him to be, which is extremely smart, extremely fun to talk to about his movies, and also, you know, a little bit cranky.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And to be fair, you know, I was meeting him on the set of his movie. He was tired like anyone else, but he was cranky in all the right ways. It wouldn't be a good Spike Lee interview if he weren't a little bit cranky.
Yeah, you
kind of appreciate that.
Yeah. Did you say anything that he kind of like challenged or?
He really did not like when I would mention other directors.
Like at all?
Yeah.
Like comparing him to them?
Right.
Okay.
I think that he is wary of us trying to understand his movies through other people's movies, except on the point of there being some confusion in some of his recent work about the role of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
He was very clear about there being a long tradition, and he's right, a long tradition of American directors who've done satire or satire-adjacent stuff where there's humor mixed into the movie, but it's a serious moral vision. And he's right that when people kind of get on his case about that, that it's a little ahistorical, that he didn't invent that. But it should also be said that he's kookier in his comedy than any of the directors he mentioned beyond Kubrick. Like Dr. Strangelove is a weird movie, and he references it in Chirac, actually. But, you know, other directors like Billy Wilder, et cetera, aren't quite as out there as Spike is.
Yeah, correctly. I mean, Black Klansman's a weird movie.
It's like
a weird
slapsticky.
Movie. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Like
and
it's
one,
weird,
the,
right.
the final non-actual footage shot. It was weird. I mean, it's like it's stylistic and stylized. And, you know, I think that he's going back to Do the Right Thing, like that's a weird movie, too. You
right,
know,
right.
Yeah. So, you know, this podcast cynically is about awards. You know, do we think that this is an awardsy movie?
I think it's definitely going to get the push.
Yeah.
I think that the Oscars in particular have not been too great to Spike Lee. I think that certainly many people in the voting body know that, and I think might see this as a chance to, A, honor something that is deeply relevant on the heels of honoring Get Out. This is produced by Jordan Peele and Jason Blum, so it's very much in that wheelhouse.
He's never been nominated, right? Is that right?
He's never been nominated as director.
Director
only as
right,
writer,
yeah.
And for documentary for Four Little
right.
Girls.
I can see, like, adapted screenplay. I think that's
yeah.
probably its best. I mean, and original screenplay is what Get Out won. So if that's kind of this, if screenplay is where the Oscars are going to honor, like, the kind of creative, off-the-beaten-path movies and, like, kind of keep Best Picture to more middle-of-the-road Oscar-y fare, then that's probably...
Yeah, I
it's
agree.
Best chance.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, we have a new Academy, so who knows? But there is a really, again, to be cynical, part of me that's like, well, Black Panther is probably going to get a Best Picture nomination. Will people say, oh, you know, our work is done? Like, we don't need, you know, like, I don't know. Like,
there
can't
can
have two
one.
Movies with black.
Right, exactly. That's too much. How dare we? Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll keep an eye on it. And in the meantime, I would urge anyone listening to read Cam's piece. It's great. And then go see the movie.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Member FDIC. Terms apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/littlegoldmen today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/littlegoldmen.
So from Cameron Collins, we move to Cameron Post. The Miseducation of Cameron Post is a movie that won Sundance. It won the kind of top prize and then kind of languished for months and finally got picked up by a distributor, I believe, for less than the budget of the movie, which is never a good thing.
Oof.
And now is coming out, small release. But it stars Chloe Grace Moretz, who is arguably a movie star.
I would say this is the movie where I realized she was a movie star,
okay,
because she is surrounded by non-movie stars beyond, to my mind, Jennifer Ely.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, oh, you're not like a normal young actor. You're like a, mm-hmm, you've got a glamour that I don't think she can quite shed, frankly.
Yeah, which is maybe a problem in this movie. So she plays a kind of regular teen in the early 90s who is caught fooling around with a friend of hers who's a girl and is sent by her religious aunt to a gay reparative therapy sort of camp, I guess you could call it. And it's about her sort of navigating those very strange waters. And it's funny because, you know, back 20 years ago, Deep Impact came out and then Armageddon came out. And then maybe the year before that, Volcano came out and then Dante's Peak came out. You know, so we're having that year, except it's
Ants and a Bug's Life.
Ants and a Bug's Life, thank you. But
right,
this year it's about gay reparative therapy for teenagers.
Right, right.
Because Boy Erased is the big one with Lucas Hedges coming out in the fall. So do we think this movie, which is directed by Desiree Akhavan, and it's her second feature film, and she is a queer woman herself, and Boy Erased is directed by, you know, a cis straight guy. And do you think Cameron Post can hold up to Boy Erased? Like in terms of like this year's, you know, estimation of this kind of subject in these movies?
Well, Boy Erased definitely has a much bigger name cast,
yeah, mm-hmm,
which is probably going to be, you know, its way into the awards conversation more so than Cameron Post. But there is definitely, I think, like an authenticity to Cameron Post that it gets, at least, you know, partially because of its creative team, that I don't know if you can necessarily count on a movie like Boy Erased to have.
Yeah, yeah. And Boy Erased is based on a memoir, and so, you know, there's a real-life story component there. But, like, yeah, something I liked about Cameron Post, and there's a lot I didn't like about the movie, to be honest, but, like, something I really like about it is that it feels unsensational, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think in particular there's some sex in the movie, and even just kissing.
Chloe Grace Moretz spends most of the movie making out with somebody.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
impressively.
Yeah, and there's nothing,
frankly,
like, kind of gazy about it, or at least male gazy about it. And there's nothing, it just feels very organic. And I feel like that's rare to see in a movie, especially one about like queer teenagers. And you know, you go back to like But I'm a Cheerleader, and that movie getting, you know, a crazy rating from the MPAA because of one scene where someone goes down on her or something. So we've made some progress on that front, that like this is not some like unrated, you know, NC-17 whatever scandal movie, but it feels real at least.
Similarly, I was just really taken with the fact that the sex in this movie is A, really frequent, and B, just sort of unremarkable in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
It just, it's not like in Call Me By Your Name where you know that the movie's moving toward that moment, that that's a thing that's going to happen and you're sort of waiting for it to happen. In this, it's pretty early and then it just keeps happening.
Or Blue Is the Warmest Color.
Or Blue Is the Warmest Color.
Which it just like still makes me uncomfortable to think about because,
yeah,
the way that those scenes are like posed and they just, yeah, they very much seem directed by a man.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, to your question about Boy Erased, I would be surprised if Boy Erased had as much sexual content as this does, in part because it's about a boy. And somehow, I just have a feeling. I can't think of like a mainstream queer movie that had as much sex as Cameron Post does, right?
Yeah. Are you saying that we're not going to get a Troye Sivan, Xavier Dolan sex scene this fall?
I think we're going to get some.
I need to change some plans.
And beyond that.
Or Nicole Kidman and Russell Crowe.
Yeah, that'll be the one sex scene in that movie.
Nicole Kidman takes that wig off.
Yeah. My God, it's like How to Get Away with Murder.
Yeah. Speaking of imperious ladies, Jennifer Ely, who you mentioned, is in this movie, and she's kind of the villain. I mean, she's the director of this camp, and she has this kind of, you know, very placid sort of therapeutic kind of demeanor.
She's kind of like a Nurse Ratched figure.
Right. Yeah, very much so. Right. She's great in this.
She really is.
And it was one of our, I think, her, like, she was in several movies at Sundance. I've been kind of negative about Chloe Grace Moretz for a while. I think I was very annoyed she got cast in Carrie. And, like, I just find her to be a little bit show kid-y. But I think she kind of does breaks through some of that here. Like, it feels like a more thoughtful performance.
I will say she's been playing teenagers for 30 years in movies? How
since
much
I
longer?
Was a teenager.
She plays teenagers the way that Jennifer Lawrence plays older women. Frankly, it's like they get stuck into these ruts that just don't match their age.
Yeah.
But Chloe's interesting to me. I watched this and I was saying to you guys earlier, this is when I noticed that she's a movie star because she's surrounded – like the other stars are great. In fact, there are people in the movie who are better than her. I think that Emily Skeggs, who plays her roommate in the movie, who's Tony-nominated actress from Fun Home, is scary. is scary in her religious oppression, but so good.
She was great.
She's fantastic. And I also think that one of the guys, Owen Campbell, who has a sort of sad storyline in the movie – is quite good too. But Chloe is just such a movie star. I just did not believe that she was a teenager in a camp. I thought that she was a
movie star. In 1993.
Right. She was a movie star surrounded by other great actors.
Yeah.
Also Sasha Lane from American Honey. Just really good younger stars. But just I kept looking at Chloe and thinking, yeah, you can't like de-glow yourself. You have like you're a magazine cover wherever you go. They didn't even try to give her like a fake zit. They just knew that we wouldn't believe.
Or like a brown dye job.
Right. Or like, right, imperfect hair. It's like, how are you such a movie star in this religious gay conversion camp?
There's one line where they're like sitting in group therapy or something and like the mean kid at camp, a D-gay camp, it says something to her like, I just look at you and I know you're a dyke. And I'm like, really? She just looks like a beautiful movie star.
And even like Chloe in character is sort of confused. And I don't think that she's confused in the way that I was confused, which is, no, she's Chloe Grace Moretz.
Yeah.
I don't know who you think you're looking at.
And a funny thing that the movie does, and I doubt it was in reaction to her being cast, but like the central character, the title character of the movie, she's so recessive and like kind of like doesn't say a lot and just sort of is there observing. And all the other characters around her, Emily Skaggs' character, Owen Campbell's character, they're doing all this big stuff. And like, and so even with this very, very muted character, Moretz just still just, it's like, no, like you're like there, I see you, you know, like,
no, totally. She could not hide.
Which is why it made zero sense for her to be cast as Carrie. Like, that's the most ridiculous casting. In movies.
Right.
Exactly.
It's such an interesting problem to have, being too charismatic, to have such problems. I do like her a lot. I don't know that she works in the scale of this movie, but she has a quality that just interests me. There's something about her where I don't look at her and think about what her characters are thinking. I just look for what they're going to do. Even despite all the sexual content in this movie, I can't think of moments where she's coming off as like, I'm horny, let me find some tail. It's more just like she just leaps to it and she just does things. And I just kind of like to see Chloe do things.
It's funny also, like I was looking back at her filmography and Chloe Grace Moretz has like so many YA adaptations that kind of went nowhere in her past. She did If I Stay, she did The Fifth Wave, so If I Stay was kind of like a weepy like romance, sort of I guess like a Fault in Our Stars type movie, and The Fifth Wave was sort of like a Hunger Games knockoff kind of movie, and The Miseducation of Cameron Post is actually also an adaptation of a YA novel. But this seemed to maybe suit her, but maybe this is kind of the sweet spot that she should be looking for, like a quieter, less bombastic something. I mean, if there's a way to do that while also seeming like she is actually the person that she's playing because she is a movie star, and right. her natural effervescence or luminescence or whatever is kind of hard to tame. But
yeah, I mean, you know, it's I really love her in Clouds of Sils Maria because she's playing a starlet, and just I was so convinced that she would be the anti-Christ to Juliette Binoche, was actually like a kind of perfect role for her. It's interesting to see that she's mostly doing these YA adaptations, as you're saying, because she, to me, is good at that, but just is out of place always.
Yeah.
She was really funny on 30 Rock, too. Just throwing
she's
that
really
out there.
Funny on 30 Rock.
She should just do a comedy.
She's yeah. so funny.
She's really funny in that scene where she's singing Four Non-Blondes.
Yeah,
that's
totally,
a great scene.
Totally.
Oh, that is a good scene. And it's, you know, it's odd that this is a YA adaptation because it doesn't have the sort of tonal trappings of a YA movie.
Right.
It's very much like a grown-up, small, independent film. And so I'm wondering, like, does this movie reach the audience it sort of maybe needs to? You know. And in 2018, I mean, reparative therapy obviously still exists and everything. But, like, I'm just kind of curious about this movie's, like, social value in a way because it doesn't have a lot of... There's not like a huge sort of discovery throughout the movie. It just kind of happens.
And the ending is just kind of like, well, now the movie's over.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and adding to that, there's also, I wonder if some people will go into a movie like this thinking, so now I'll get to see what it's like in these sort of de-gaying camps. But watching the movie, I don't know. Like, that voyeuristic sense for me was not satisfied by the
movie,
actually.
Because life doesn't really seem that bad in the DK.
Yes. Can we talk about the freedom that they had to even just go on hikes?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole subplot in this movie about some of the kids sneaking off to grow weed in the forest. And it's like, but you're at this, like, Christian camp. How is no one paying attention to you going off into the woods to smoke weed? Or, like, how are they letting you even be alone if the whole idea is that you're at risk of falling into the gay again? Like, why would they let two women go off into the woods together?
I don't understand why they bunk same-sex roommates.
Right.
That's bizarre.
Like, there's a sex scene in one of their rooms, and it's just like, so there's no one monitoring? Not that I want them to be, but it's more like, I guess I had a much more probably myopic, violent, not in the physical violent sense, but just in the emotionally violent sense of what was going on here. Although, to be fair, this is also apparently a movie about people who are running one of these camps who don't really know what they're doing.
And one of whom is himself, mm-hmm. played by John Gallagher Jr., like, has been through the program.
Right.
Which the movie kind of teases at a little bit. But yeah, I think that what the movie felt lacking to me was a sense of stakes. And
yeah.
I appreciate that Akhavan is trying to do something subtle and, you know, understated and
not make the people running the camp these cartoonish,
exactly, right. And not right. make their conditions hellish, you know, just for the sake of, you know, filmed drama. But, like, boy, it's hard to grab onto anything, you know.
Yeah.
The kid Owen Campbell, who has the sort of tragic arc in the film, like, he is such a good theatery kind of, you know, actor. Like, he has this big monologue where it's just like, oh, he's done that on stage at, like, a high school drama competition. Like, fully.
That was his audition. Yeah. Oh,
he played
monologue.
John Proctor.
Oh, and did he? Yeah, he found his goodness. You know, and so when those kind of things briefly happen in the movie, you're like, oh, like, this is something to hold on to. And then the movie just sort of recedes again, and we're back to Chloe kind of staring. And I
right.
just, yeah, it just, it for me, it did not get the blood up the way that I wanted it to.
I can see I can see Boy Erased being more dramatic in
yeah.
that way.
Yeah.
Or
I mean,
melodramatic.
Even the trailer, like, you know, with him staring at this, like, poster of this torso or whatever. I don't know. There just seems to be a lot more, like.
No, yeah, totally. I mean, something weird about this movie is just, I mean, I know people often accuse movies of or feel, you know, negatively toward movies for having what's called a kind of Sundance-y feel or a Sundance-y arc. And generally, I hear that complaint, but I'm also like, well, this is sort of an opportunity to see what's unique about a movie when it's kind of adhering to formula. You can actually pick out what's interesting about it. But in this case, I just kept being frustrated by the fact that there were details that I just wanted more of. Like you mentioned, like John Gallagher having gone through the camp and being the brother of Jennifer Ely's character. There's there. I wanted a little bit more of that. I wanted more of Jennifer Ely's character. I wanted to know more about these people running this thing. And I also just wanted more of other characters who seem, I mean, there's one woman at the camp who loves to sing. And her character is probably one of the most poignant in the movie because for her, it's like this actual suppression of her voice that's happening. And things like that felt like flourishes I wanted to sort of feel like I knew more.
Yeah, it's a 90-minute movie.
Yeah.
It could maybe have been beefed up, especially because looking into it, I think the book is like 500 pages long.
Oh,
like,
wow.
They cut out a lot. I think they focused very much like on like the last third of the book, and that you basically see Cameron's life like from childhood until her parents die in a car crash, which happens at the beginning, and like through her relationship with her girlfriend before she gets sent away. And like, so there's a lot there. That the movie doesn't get into, which might have been interesting.
Right,
maybe it would have made Cameron feel more like a well-rounded person.
Yeah, just like a little bit of, like, to use a word that we don't normally use to for this kind of movie, world building.
Yeah.
Frankly.
Well, Forrest Goodluck is an actor who plays a character in the movie who's Lakotan, and he has this whole... Not whole, actually. It's kind of a mentioned thing about Lakotan beliefs about, you know, gender and how gender can kind of change and, you know, and
right.
all this stuff. And I'm like, wait, I want to watch that movie. Like, that
yeah.
sounds fascinating.
Right.
Like, I don't necessarily need to see this, like, you know, sort of conventionally pretty white girl, like, you know, like, struggle with
growing
this, like,
weed
like,
in some ditch.
I want to talk to this, like, Lakotan kid who, like, has all this kind of elevated spiritual thinking about this and Sasha Lane's character with, you know, who has a physical disability. Like, there's interesting stuff there that the movie could dig into
yeah.
that, you know, made me say, hey, this should be a TV show.
Yeah.
I mean, the Lakotan character, for example, he's the character that Jennifer Ely's character is the meanest to because
yeah.
his hair is always in his face. And... when you notice that, when you notice that she's being the meanest to him, at least for me, it's like, so is this, like, tell me, give me a little bit of a sense. Don't make it explicit necessarily, but, like, is this about the femininity thing? Is it a race thing? Like, what is her perspective? Does she have one? Or is she just picking on this one kid in a sort of meaningless way? And, you know, just why doesn't she, I don't know, why doesn't she have particular things that she wants to fix about every kid? That seems like what she would do. You know, just things like that where it's like, I need... less plot point and more evoke these people for me because they're all characters are all so rich, frankly.
Well, I'd say the movie is still worth seeing. It's now kind of being slowly rolled out in theaters. I'm sure it'll be on demand. Maybe you can use the last vestiges of your movie pass to go see it.
The only kind of movie
yeah,
you can
yeah,
use
yeah, yeah,
movie
yeah,
pass
yeah,
for anymore.
Yeah. That does it for us this week. As ever, you can follow us at Little Gold Men. I am on Twitter at Rylaws. Cam?
I'm on Twitter at Melville Matic.
And Hillary?
And I am Hillabuster with two R's.
This episode was edited and produced by Daniel Roth. And this week's award for the best reveal of where Mike, Katie, and Joanna went goes to Cam Collins.
Some of the kids sneaking off to grow weed in the forest.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.